Where yeah. Fumble around going, where am I?
This meeting of the Senate Energy and Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. I know we had a joint hearing earlier in the week that I was not able to be at, and I apologize for that as well as for the laryngitis. But and I understand there was at least some brief introduction of staff, but I wanted to just spend a minute or two more making sure everybody knows who is who working here on staff things. I'll start with Senate Counsel and Research, and I don't know if, Carlin, if you want to just introduce yourself, tell them what areas you'll be covering and so on.
I will. Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carlin Doyle Fontaine. I am Senate Counsel, and I'll be handling the environment issues. And some of it will also be following the energy issues, but John Fuller will be the lead counsel on that.
Greg Knapp, Senate Analyst. My specialties are in agriculture and environment and natural resources.
And John Fuller.
Hi, I'm John Fuller. I work in the Senate Council on energy issues, so I'll be here when there's energy hammer leave now because I work with Greg on the ag and jobs committee, and I do higher ed council too.
And so whenever, if committee members ever feel they want counsel who is not here to be here, just try and let them know in advance and so on. But Senate Counsel and Research always tries to go out of their way to be available when they think there's a chance they'll be needed too. But so that's it for Senate Counsel and Research, and thank you, John. And for the caucus research staffs, Gloria Gunville and
Gloria Gunville.
John Halverson, Republican Research.
And then for the committee staff, Barb?
I'm Barb Jacobs. I'm the committee administrator.
And then Tina Mackey, the committee legislative assistant.
And we have a full agenda in front of us this this session. I think it's going to be a busy committee. I look forward to having a chance for us to have some good presentations and good discussion of bills in the coming months. And our page is Andrew. I haven't even met Andrew yet, more than briefly.
If you have any needs, just signal to me. I'll be sitting right here.
And today we are going to be dealing with two confirmations, that of Commissioner John Linkstein to the MPCA, and Brian Knapstad is chair of the Board of Soil and Water Resources. And then after that, we'll be having some brief presentations on the EQB and the MPCA and the DNR. And I always think there's a balance between how much informational stuff people go to, but there are a lot of new members on the committee and a lot of things changing over time. So we figured brief overview. And again, I will assure the members of the committee that when the departments come up here, I hope their legislative liaisons will be thoroughly introduced, because I know under all the previous administrations and the current one, the legislative liaisons do try and be there as soon as you call them as members of the legislature, and I hope we can have that continuing good relationship. With that, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Designate John Linkstein to the table, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. It's good to be here, and I wanted to just give you three basic things today as introduction, then and answer any questions you have about me and about our agency that I can answer. I want to give you a brief background on myself, who I am, where I grew up, what I've done in my career. I want to talk a little bit about the accomplishments of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I want to talk about what lies ahead and sort of the vision of the future that I'm trying to bring with my staff to the agency. A little bit about myself. I grew up in Roseville. I went to Alexander Ramsey High School before it was unfortunately merged with a neighboring school, our rival school, Frank B. Kellogg, and became Roseville Area High School. I will never fully adopt that name, Mr. Chair. I attended the University of Minnesota College of Agriculture. And I was graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree there in soil and water resource management. So my background was really to be trained as a soil conservation service technician. I didn't follow that path. I went to work for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources out of college as a hydrologist dealing with land use issues and other flooding, public waters regulation, and hydrologic alterations of wetlands, pumping of groundwater, regulation of groundwater use, flood damage reduction. And I also did a little bit of work while I was at the DNR on trails and waterways management. I have then, that was 25 years that I spent with the Department of Natural Resources in various levels of hydrologic work, always dealing with regulation and regulated parties, as well as promoting water and land use practices that would benefit the state's hydrology. I moved from the Department of Natural Resources in 2005 to the Minnesota Department of Health. There I worked in environmental health issues, including the state's drinking water program, the state well code, as well as public health emergencies. And you might recall that H1N1 influenza that we had once upon a time. I was responsible for managing the state's response to that public health epidemic. I also was responsible while at the Department of Health for the finding of perfluorinated compounds, PFCs, in drinking water supplies in South Washington County and across other parts of the state, and how to establish drinking water protection standards for those contaminants while allowing for the cleanup and protection of public health. In March of 2011, I joined the Pollution Control Agency when Paul Austin was the commissioner, and I was the deputy commissioner. And just this past May, when Paul left this, the Pollution Control Agency to be the city coordinator for the city of Minneapolis, Governor Dayton named me to the post of commissioner. I wanted to speak a little bit to the accomplishments of the agency and how this administration views its work. The agency is strongly science-based and data-driven. We monitor and collect information about the state's air, land, and water. We work with our regulated parties and with citizens all over the state to assure that we are improving the environment and protecting public health. Some positive examples of measuring our progress have been coming up lately. The agency took shape originally in 1967, and its first efforts were around wastewater treatment plant controls and improvement. And recently, our study of dissolved oxygen levels as a result of phosphorus in the Minnesota River showed that wastewater treatment plants upstream of the lower 20-mile section from Shakopee to Fort Snelling have been doing a successful job of eliminating phosphorus from their wastewater discharges. And we found sufficient levels of dissolved oxygen in the Minnesota River to support a healthy aquatic community of fish and macroinvertebrates. In fact, the DNR's monitoring efforts this past summer during low flow conditions showed that walleyes and muskies were found as far up as St. Peter and Mankato. We have done a remarkable job of handling closed landfills, county-based landfills that needed to be remediated and cleaned up. There are 112 old landfills in our program. 110 of those landfills have successfully been remediated and put into a long-term maintenance and operations program where methane is collected, groundwater leachate is collected and treated, and we have two landfills left in the state that have not yet been fully remediated. One is in Eden Prairie, the Flying Cloud landfill, and the other is in Burnsville, the freeway landfill. Those two landfills remain for us to come up with plans to remediate, and we look forward to doing that. Our agency has done a significant amount of work in reducing the point sources of air emissions, ranging from mercury and particulate matter, the fine soot particles in the air, and ozone and greenhouse gases that produce ozone. We have also built a strong culture of continuous improvement and regulatory streamlining. With our current work, we have over 100 performance measures as an agency, and some of you are probably looking at our dashboard. It's a two-page document. This is a sample of some of our metrics of performance that we use as an agency to improve our work. Under Governor Dayton's administration, he issued an executive order directing the agency to set a 150-day goal for issuance of all permits. We have successfully met that goal. We are at 96% complete, 150 days for all permits that create jobs or are for new facilities that need the permits to operate. Overall, our permitting efficiency is in the mid-80% level. About 84% of all permits that we process are now issued within 150 days. We have a 96% overall compliance level with permitting requirements of somewhere between 15,000 and 18,000 permit holders that operate in Minnesota on an annual basis. And nationally, we're recognized as being having programs that are leaders for monitoring and protection and cleanup of air, land, and water. One of the examples that we had this last year was in Cloquet, Minnesota, where we coordinated with two major industries, SAPI and USG, who both were trying to had opportunities to upgrade their facilities with some significant investment money of about $20 million. They were they also needed to meet more strict air emission requirements. And working together with these two industries, we were able to coordinate our efforts and their air quality control and emissions control activities so that they could retain 750 jobs and meet their air and water quality standards. That process of upgrading their permits and revising their permits with their investments was completed in less than 6 months. I want to talk briefly about what's ahead for the Pollution Control Agency. And as I said, we rely on sound science. We rely on the data that we collect on our environment and on our permitting and the work of our partners. We want to continue to improve our permitting timeliness and efficiency. We are doing this while we maintain our efforts to improve and protect air quality, water quality, and land restoration. Last week, Governor Dayton's Chief of Staff, Tina Smith, announced that the agency would tighten its permitting goals to 90 days for certain categories of permits. We support that because of our commitment to continuous improvement. We're meeting our goals for many of our categories of permits, and when you meet your goals, like any good manager will tell you, then it's time to review your goals and tighten them. And we are tightening our goals to on the categories of permits that are less complex, involve more straightforward decision-making and review of processes, and that do not involve extensive public review or comment periods. So that will benefit our permittees as well as communities around the state by getting getting permits processed more quickly. It is time for us to update our 17-year-old data system. We have a system in our agency called Delta. It's our permitting engine. All of our staff use various components of this in our air permitting, in our water permitting, and in some of our solid waste permitting. The system is built, as many were 17 years ago, around data entry that's inside the agency, built on separated access databases. It's time to modernize that database. It's time to turn it outwards towards our clients. And just as many other businesses and entities have done, rely on the people who are applying for permits to enter the data into our system and have that information available to them on an ongoing basis. At the same time, we want to improve the access of the public to that data so that they can see where things are at in the process, so they can understand the data that we have about air, land, and water statewide, and have better access to our information. Those upgrades are going to be a priority for this administration so that we can modernize and do business at a greater rate of timeliness for business and also for transparency for public access. It's time to return to the language of public health inside the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. For years, we've talked about environment. We've talked about the benefits of protecting, maintaining, and improving the environment. We need to remember that we do that not only for the quality of the environment, but the quality of human life. And We know that our air and our land and our water are important to our public health, especially when we look at air quality. And we need to have, as we have a growing understanding of how asthma, cardiopulmonary diseases, and other forms of personal health conditions are brought to greater levels of risk through exposure to particulate matter and ozone and other contaminants in our air, it's time to take a careful look at how public health and health care costs are driven by air quality conditions, especially in densely populated areas of the state and areas where there are populations that are at risk because of their particular population demographics. On water, we have been doing, as I said, on the Minnesota River, an outstanding job. The staff of the agency and our partners and the permitted community have been doing an excellent job of decreasing discharges to public waters in the state. The business community, the wastewater treatment facilities, and industry across the state have done their fair share and are continuing to do their fair share. The unregulated non-point sources of pollution that are contributing sediment and other nutrients to our waterways are now the remaining area of concern for the agency. And we need to do more to get ahead of non-point source pollution and the hydrologic system changes that are driving a lot of erosion and sediment delivery on channels and streams across Minnesota. To help in that regard, Governor Dayton has joined with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Agriculture, our agency, and other entities to build an agricultural water quality certification program. And that program hopefully will build on voluntary efforts to improve water quality and secure agreements from landowners to use best management practices on their property for a significant period of time to protect and improve water quality. In our land area, it's time, as I said earlier, we have two landfills remaining in the state in our closed landfill program. I would love to finish the work of this program and put those two landfills into long-term maintenance. Without that, they continue to be risks to our groundwater and to greenhouse gas emissions. Lastly, we can do better with our solid waste management, and we'd like to see our recycling rates increase in the state. Currently, the state is about at 45% of our solid waste stream as recycled or composted material. We know from studies of the solid waste stream across the state that approximately 70% of all of our solid waste is capable of being composted or recycled. But before that, we'd like to see less waste produced. We work with business owners and communities to reduce their overall volume of waste production. And that goes back to that old mantra, reduce, reuse, and recycle. We hope we can do better as a state, and we're interested in learning more from a variety of partners and stakeholders how we can continue to improve on our recycling rate. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I have is, I would like to know what assurances you can provide us that your agency is going to be capable of standing up to political and corporate pressure to provide less than stringent regulatory oversight of the new sulfide copper nickel mines.
One of the regarding Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, the as we look at mining projects, obviously there's a significant environmental review component to the establishment of any new mining facility in Minnesota, and the copper nickel and other non-ferrous mining activities that are currently under development or under consideration for development will undergo scrutinous environmental review programs, first led by the Department of Natural Resources, and the PCA and the DNR are partners in that process. Our interest is in maintaining the standards, and as you know, our agency requires industries to meet standards for water quality discharges. Our track record proves that we do not bend under pressure. We've been the source of a lot of litigation over the years from all sides. Our job is to set effective water quality standards, effective air quality standards, and then defend them. That's been our track record, and that will be our record going forward.
Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Stein. The last time I was in this room, I was on the Ag Committee, so we're maybe getting a little cross-pollination. But you mentioned the joint Ag Water Quality Initiatives, and there's been a little concern in the agriculture community about regulation of pesticides and farm chemicals being moved over to the PCA. Is that something you're comfortable addressing at this time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, the Department of Agriculture already has a pesticide regulation and fertilizer program. We are committed to working with the Department of Agriculture as they monitor the progress and results of their program. I've had a long-standing experience with the agency, with my professional career, working with the Department of Agriculture, and we support them in their ability to implement the program. It's not been an issue that within the administration, we believe that the Department of Agriculture is fully capable of implementing that program.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Stein, I just want to say congratulations. And I'm very excited about you, to have you as the commissioner, because I did some extensive work with the commissioner on the methamphetamine bill. And I believe your experience in the Department of Health and your notion of public health is very, very important going forward. So he was outstanding to work with, and we did a good bill, and I appreciate it. That was a long time ago. That was 2005, I believe, Commissioner.
That's correct. Reilly. Yep. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Welcome.
Senator Hare.
Yep. Commissioner, I just want to let you know, since I'm new to the Senate, I'm very impressed with the dashboard that handout. It's everything is all included in one sheet, so I'm quite impressed in that. And also, you know, glad that you have natural resource experience moving from Department of Natural Resource. And so I'm glad that transition will benefit MPCA quite well. But my question to you is that can you touch upon what is the agency is doing to include low-income community into a decision-making? So, are planning to do?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Hur, thank you for the compliment on our dashboard. We're about 2 weeks away from updating this, so you'll get new data. And I've seen the early information. It's not all good news. And I guess I just want to emphasize that we don't put out this information only to tell the positive side of our story. It's to tell how we're doing, kind of like the seventh grade algebra teacher. I like to show my work. The work of the agency is important. I like to see it demonstrated over time. Regarding your question about low income and ethnic and diverse communities, the agency is committed to improving our efforts to reach out. We have an initiative that we've labeled Environmental Equity. You might have heard in the Environmental Protection Agency, they speak about environmental justice, and we know that from our data on public health and our data on the environment that populations vary in their income distribution, in their ethnic distribution, and that those can oftentimes pair up with some other environmental hazards and risks in their communities. And some of the communities in Minnesota are at disproportionate levels of environmental exposure risk. So we are committed through a program called Environmental Equity to reach out to community-based partners who have connections within low-income communities, within ethnic communities, and so forth, to try to draw people into our processes more effectively. Because when we this often comes to our attention when we go out on a public hearing or public meeting for an air permit or a water permit, and we're in a community there to talk about the permit. Community members are motivated to talk about what concerns them about their community. And oftentimes they're concerned about things that are outside the scope of our permit. But we're committed to try to bring those interests together and work cooperatively to pair them up with the right units of government or assistance programs or other sources of assistance that might benefit their interests. It's important from my experience. I've been in government now my whole career. I've been working as a government employee since 1978. I don't like to show up and say I'm here from the government and I'm here to help and be lying when I say it. I like to show up and actually know what the community wants to talk about and do my best to address their concerns. So that's our commitment. It's going to take extra work on the part of our agency and on our staff, but we're willing to take it on because it's important to do to answer the community's questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, I wanted to follow up on, and I mentioned this to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka the other day, on the report card thing. I really appreciate what you said about we want to report what's out there, not just the good news, but on that, and I may be incorrect in this and so on, but for instance, on the hazardous waste one, is the amount of hazardous waste generated decreasing? And it talks about how any commercial entity that produces any amount of waste is regulated as a generator. And then it says since 2003, the number of generators has dropped by more than half, and the corresponding drop in amount of waste. I would read that as saying that, in effect, we're generating less than half the amount of waste. But if I understand correctly, what's happened is we don't require the generators to report to us anymore for half the generators. We all of a sudden half the waste doesn't even show up anymore. And in that case, what I'm saying is I agree with what you were saying.
Yep.
I'm just saying that I hope the new one does that, because if that's accurate, then in effect this is a rose-colored glasses. And it's natural. Any agency wants to put out – everybody wants to have A's on the report card. And I just want to get your comment on that, because there are several things in here that I'd like. I think your point is right. We want to be straightforward with what's out there, good and bad, rather than just whatever, sugarcoating it, I guess.
And, Senator, you're absolutely correct, Mr. Chair, that the story is somewhat nuanced on the toxic on the hazardous waste generating graph on the land and waste side of our dashboard. In 2002, there was a change in definition of who was required to submit reports. So that significant drop from 2001 to 2002 is an artifact and can be misleading. So we don't want, we are going to clarify that and try to do a better job. All that said, we are seeing improvements in the amount of hazardous waste being generated. That means that business owners are converting to less hazardous materials and are finding ways to release less hazardous waste in their processes. And that's overall good for the state. But it's not as dramatic as this graph would indicate.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I hope in the new report cards, because, again, the compliance rates of 100% compliance with air permits and so on, I mean, I just want to make sure that the agency, and I think you understand the importance of this, of not sugarcoating things.
Absolutely agree. In fact, Mr. Chair, you're right that the 100% was a result of the date that the data was collected. The more contemporary information will show somewhere in the 90s as far as compliance with air permits.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for being before our committee today. And I have to say, I'm from the part of Roseville that's in the Frank B. Kellogg area, so I'll try not to hold that against you from your previous comments. But
well, I have a story to tell you, Senator, but I'll wait for another time.
Yes, I have a question in the solid waste area regarding the polluted holding ponds, and I've looked at your resume and I've seen that you've come from the DNR and come into the PCA, and they've been somewhat involved in that. And as you know, we have probably 20,000 in the metro area of polluted holding ponds that will need to go, as we know now, into a remediation program and a lined landfill. And I'm wondering, have we funded that adequately, and have you worked on that process? I'm just kind of curious about your background there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, yes. You're describing the problem that, you know, I can fully embrace as part of my career, that when I was young and we were dealing with stormwater runoff, we told people direct that runoff to holding ponds, direct it to natural wetlands, because it was the only available option at the time. As we've learned, That resulted in additional contaminants being released into natural wetlands and into created ponds. As we've seen, the unintended consequences of a practice of sealing roads and driveways with materials that contain polyaromatic hydrocarbons. Yes, I've worked on that issue when I was at the Department of Health. Those substances, when excavated, can be at levels that are toxic and can be classified, could be classified as hazardous. If that's the case, then we can't simply dispose of them outside a specific kind of a landfill. Currently, there is no actual state-level assistance to remediate those basins. Many communities are dealing with the problem, and I'm happy to report that most Minnesota businesses have now adopted a practice that will no longer use those polyaromatic hydrocarbon-containing compounds in their sealants. That said, there's still a lot of remediation to be done out there. We would welcome the discussion of what that might take.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there further discussion from Senator Eaton?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your service, Mr. Stein. I didn't mean to just go right into my question before. I'm wondering what your vision is for improving the regulation of toxic chemicals in Minnesota, particularly those that affect children.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton. When I was at the Health Department, part of the responsibility of the division I managed was to work on establishing levels of concern for toxic materials in water and in air. And that information is done at the Department of Health and then reported to the Pollution Control Agency and other regulators. I'm looking at Senator Sieben. We worked together on a project for establishing the Toxic Free Kids Act in Minnesota that established a basic framework for making a list of hazardous materials, toxic chemicals that children might be reasonably exposed to, and prioritizing that list. Legislation and the programs that evolved between the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency still exist, and we monitor efforts across the country and within Minnesota to further reduce exposure to children to toxic materials. The limits of the program are such that we make the list, we understand the nature of the hazards, we work together with the other agencies to update those lists. We do not yet have any reporting responsibilities for the listed materials across the state, nor are there additional efforts that would further engage the public in understanding what that means. Our initial reports and our follow-up reports, both from the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency, have recommended further reporting as well as further public information and education efforts.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Stein. I appreciate your service to the state. You've got a very long and distinguished record. I have a question regarding watersheds. Hennepin County Commissioner Johnson has proposed perhaps reconfiguring or condensing or changing our current system of watersheds, perhaps to make them more efficient, make them more able to function better over maybe even through wider geographic areas. Are you familiar with this proposal, and do you have any position on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, yes, I'm familiar with the proposal. I actually sat on the team that the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute staffed to evaluate various options. Let me just say, with regard to watershed management, I'm familiar with the Hennepin County situation. It's reflective of other situations across the state. And I know that the Board of Water and Soil Resources staff are in the room today, and their basic responsibilities that are outlined in the law for water planning and management are complemented by our agency's efforts to monitor watershed conditions and look for restoration and protection strategies. It's important to note that there are more than 250 local units of government charged with some level of water governance responsibility. Yesterday, we delivered our final report evaluating water governance in the state. Five state agencies and the Metropolitan Council cooperated in that report, and it should have been delivered electronically, I hope, Kirk, today. Sorry. My apologies. One of the things we outlined in that report is that it's important to move from individual unit of government-based water planning and management to a more watershed-based approach. And I think it can be argued that we need to look carefully at how many local units of government should be responsible for that activity. I supported the university's recommendation to Hennepin County to reduce and consolidate the number of watershed organizations, and I think that's another idea that should be further explored on a statewide basis.
Thank you.
Further, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stein, I was just looking at your dashboard here, and you have a statement on greenhouse gases that they're declining per capita emissions. And so I'm wondering what your agency would be doing to help meet Minnesota's greenhouse gas reduction goals.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, we continue to drive toward the data, monitoring data, to help us understand whether those reductions in per capita greenhouse gas emissions are related to economic activity and the sort of the general nature of the economy, or if they're tied more specifically to improvement efforts on energy production, vehicle miles traveled. So we work hard with a number of other agencies to address greenhouse gas emissions and how those can be better measured and better reduced with time. It's important to note that we're growing. Our population is growing. The number of vehicle miles traveled in the state is accelerating. We are going to look for ways to address that with our other agency partners so that we can lead by example in greenhouse gas emissions. We want to do that through cooperative efforts, gathering the data, reporting on the data, engaging the sectors of the economy and society that can contribute to further reductions.
Thank you.
Further discussion? If not, is there a motion, Senator? Motion for confirmation?
So moved.
Senator Eaton moves that Committee on Environment and Energy recommends the appointment of John Link Stein as Commissioner of the, that the appointment of Commissioner John Link Stein to the Pollution Control Agency be confirmed by the Senate. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and aye the same.
Thank you. Mr. Napstead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. It's an honor to be before you. I was asked to appear today and provide some personal and professional background to you regarding myself, talk a little bit about the Board of Water and Soil Resources accomplishments, and then talk a little bit about future vision. So if it pleases the board, I'll dive into that. First of all, I didn't grow up quite as close to here as Commissioner Stein did. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. I attended the University of Wisconsin and graduated the University of Wisconsin in 1980. From a personal standpoint, I met my wife of 27 years, Sharon, at the University of Wisconsin, and we have three boys, Josh, who's a 2011 graduate of Bemidji State University. Chad is going to graduate this May if everything works out, and it looks like it's going to, from Bemidji State also. And our youngest, Ryan, is going to the University of Wisconsin. Upon graduating college in 1980, I wound up in the Twin Cities. I went to work for National Computer Systems out of Edina originally, and spent time with General Electric Corporation and finally Hewlett-Packard right over in Roseville on Larpinder Avenue. My wife Sharon and I had a long-standing passion to live in northern Minnesota. We wound up purchasing our first cabin up in northern Minnesota in 1990, and it had long been our goal to move north. We thought we had more time to think about it, but eventually the kids got to an age where we thought we had better make a decision if we were going to do it or not, and we'd always dreamt of doing it, We were more concerned about the regrets of looking back and saying we didn't take the opportunity than we were about the challenges that we may face. So we left the Twin Cities and moved up to our cabin up north and kind of wondered what we would do. It didn't take very long, though. I set about designing a restaurant, which we began building immediately upon getting up there. The name of the restaurant is Fisherman's Bay. It's on Highway 65, right across the street from Big Sandy Lake. Big Sandy Lake is the lake we live on up there. Fisherman's Bay is, we opened that in June of 2000, and we've been fortunate enough to host a number of your colleagues there, as a matter of fact. Senator Saxhawk, former Senator, former Representative Solberg, on their commute back and forth to Grand Rapids would stop in. Senator Metzen has a place on Big Sandy Lake, so I've conversed with Senator Metzen there before, and also the late Senator Scheid. She had a cabin on Lake Minnewawa, which is just adjacent to Big Sandy Lake. So it's been a real opportunity to meet an awful lot of people and get to know a lot of good friends. Consistent with opening a restaurant, you, as I indicated, you get to know a lot of people, talk, have a lot of conversations. And probably in 2002, people started urging that I run for public office. Well, in Aiken County, the office that's available is county commissioner. So I decided to give it a shot, and in 2004, I ran for Aiken County commissioner and was elected. I was reelected in 2008 and then reelected again in 2012, just recently. And as all the members know, when you are elected to public office, one of the first things you do is determine which committees you're going to be interested in serving on or which you're going to be assigned to. Because of my interest in natural resources, I naturally veered off into that direction. I've had a longstanding interest in all natural resources, water, rivers, wildlife, swimming. It's just it's kind of the reason we chose to move up north. So the committees I've served on and presently serve on since becoming a commissioner swearing in 2005, I'm currently the Aiken County representative of the Mississippi Headwaters Board. Many of you are probably familiar with the Headwaters Board. It's an eight counties joint powers board. Our job is to protect the first 400 miles of the Mississippi River, which is either categorized as wild and scenic or natural. So we do that through a variety of land use plans. I am also representative of the Joint Powers Natural Resources Board, which is a seven-county joint powers board, which works very closely with consolidated conservation land. It's not a common type of land in Minnesota, ConCon land, but these seven counties have all of the ConCon land in the state of Minnesota, and we work together with the Department of Natural Resources and federal agencies to ensure that those lands are properly managed. Other committees I belong to are the Northern Counties Land Use Coordinating Board. As the name implies, we coordinate the natural resource activities in the northern part of Minnesota. The Aiken County Forest Advisory Committee. Aiken County was one of the, was the first county in the state of Minnesota to become FSC certified, which is the certification practice now that you're seeing more and more on consumer goods. And then finally, I've been a longtime member of the Association of Minnesota Counties Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. And lastly, I'll just mention the Northeast Waste Advisory Committee that operates out of Duluth. And of course, each county and county commissioners need to be concerned with when that garbage is picked up or when those recyclables are picked up, it has to go somewhere. And obviously the general public's not keenly aware of that, but we do have to make those arrangements. So I was naturally involved in many of these committees when it became came to my attention that there was an opening on the Bowser board. I applied to become a Bowser board member and have been a Bowser board member since 2005. In 2010, our current Chairman Randy Kramer's term expired, and so I applied to become the chairman of the Bowser Board and was appointed chairman in, I believe it was October of 2010, which is why I'm before you here today. As I indicated, I've been with Bowser for a while. I'd like to talk about just some of the accomplishments. There have been many over the years. I think some that I'd like to highlight upon are our RIM WRP program. I think many people in Minnesota are familiar with the Reinvest in Minnesota program. The WRP is where people become a little less familiar. That's a wetland restoration program through the federal government, part of the Farm Bill. It's implemented through the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And the importance of the RIM WRP program is that that is the mechanism by which Bowser places easements upon property. We have a longstanding tradition capability of creating easements on sensitive property to protect resources that are sensitive in need of protection. So, for example, in the RIM WRP program, we may identify sensitive land along rivers, streams, lakes that need to have a setback from farming or some man-made activity so that we don't see erosion and problems in the water and the water quality. Minnesota, through Bowser, has become recognized as a national leader in the RIM WRP program. We leverage about $1.4 federal dollars for every dollar of state investment. So we appreciate the substantial investment the state of Minnesota has made in the RIM program through bonding and constitutional dollars, and hope we can keep up that important activity of keeping easements on those sensitive properties. That's going to be an area of challenge moving into the future. As we all know, high commodity prices and high land prices are going to make re-enrolling some of these easements more difficult than in the past. But Bowser is committed to working on that activity because it's an important conservation practice. The another program that is also of great importance, which is similar to the RIM WRP, is the buffer program. As we all know, it's important to have buffers, some sort of natural buffer, in between man-made activities and riparian type areas. So Bowser has had a longstanding buffer program. I believe in just 2011 alone, we enrolled about 1,000 acres into the buffer program. And while 1,000 acres may not sound like a lot of acreage, when you think about it in a linear format, in a width ranging from one rod to, say, 100 feet, that truly is a lot of resource protection along waterways. Drinking water protection has been an important area for Bowser as well. Thankfully, the residents of Minnesota, the citizens of Minnesota, voted in the constitutional amendments for the 3/8 of 1% tax money. And we've been...
Excuse me, Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a while since I've referred to anything in terms of a rod for long. Could you help me? What is a rod?
16 and a half feet.
Thank you.
I apologize. The drinking water wellhead protection zone program, again, money funded through the legislature, has allowed us to create easements around wellheads to protect those groundwaters. And these are permanent easements. That's an important distinguishing feature. These easements will be there in place forever for these municipal type well activities. The ACUB program, very unique program throughout the United States, the Army Compatible Use Buffer Program. Camp Ripley, up around Little Falls, has found that conducting their operations in an area that's expanding residentially is becoming more and more of a challenge. So the Army has provided a substantial number of dollars, and we are matching some of those dollars to place easements on the lands around the fort. Farm fields and agricultural activities are very compatible with training type activities that you'll find up at Camp Ripley, whereas having a residential home with a, you know, with the kids playing in the backyard right up against an Army training base is not very compatible. So we have worked in conjunction with our federal partners to implement the Army Compatible Use Buffer Program, which has benefited both the Army from preserving their training capability, but from a state interest, it's protected the woods, the wildlife, and the waters of the state for our resources. An area that seemed somewhat vague to me a while ago, became much more clear this past year. Bowser has been more and more involved in disaster responses, particularly flood-type disasters. We all remember the floods down in southeastern Minnesota. We all recall often the Red River Valley issues. Northeastern Minnesota had a significant flood this summer, right where I live, in fact. In fact, I found out what it's like to not be able to get to your home during the summer because the roads are flooded. And it was very refreshing to see the role that Bowser took in responding to flood damage and the like from a personal perspective. So our activities in southeast and northwestern Minnesota regarding flood damage seemed a little bit far away. Obviously, we were helping Minnesotans, which is very important. But to see the actual activities and the actual projects on the ground locally is a very important thing, and that's a continued important activity of Bowser. I think the last thing I'll just comment on Bowser is Bowser is a unique agency. It's a small agency in the state of Minnesota, but we're able to leverage the agency into a much larger appearance due to the fact that we deal closely with our local partners. Most counties have a soil and water conservation district or wetland districts or watershed districts, for example. We're able to work with and act like we are staff to one another. It's a very important partnership role. Aiken County, for example, our SWCD is funded by the county, but there are natural resources block grant dollars coming from the state of Minnesota so that our SWCD can implement and enforce the Wetland Conservation Act, shoreland activities, feedlot activities in counties that have feedlots, and so on. So there's kind of a symbiotic relationship between our SWCDs and the Bowser Board and staff that give us the appearance of a much larger agency when, in fact, we're probably one of the smallest of the state. Finally, a recent accomplishment of the Bowser Board has been the oversight and approval of the wetland report that just gone to Governor Dayton. Governor Dayton issued an executive order last year directing Bowser to develop a report on ways to improve and streamline wetland regulation, ways to make wetland regulation better in the state of Minnesota. And that report was recently delivered. In fact, I believe our executive director was responsible for assembling a team here yesterday that provided some overview to that report. Lastly, I think I've taken enough of your time here. I'll just talk a little bit about vision. And I think one of the principal things I'd like to talk about is Senator Osmick's comment, and that is with regard to managing water on a watershed level. I think the vision I would like to convey from Bowser's perspective is we need to move to that watershed management perspective. As Commissioner Stein said earlier, we have over 250 water organizations in the state. Each of these organizations has a water management plan. There are a lot of duplicative activities that are happening. Coordination could occur better. Dollars may be doubled up on. I would like to see us move to that model where we are operating on a watershed basis. First of all, scientifically, it simply makes sense to do things on a hydrologic basis. You can't separate that side of the bathtub from that side of the bathtub. So I think it's just scientifically logical to do that. It's practical to do that, and I think what we as an agency need to do is to determine the methodology to pragmatically put that on the ground. We have the partners that are on the ground, the soil and water conservation districts and the watersheds. We need to determine the methodology by which we utilize the state dollars provided by yourselves, which we currently use as incentives for the natural resources block grants, to assist us in moving these organizations from operating on political boundaries, which is the tradition, to watershed boundaries. And there's a lot to that comment. Just understanding the watershed boundaries can be a challenge. now with the advent of LIDAR and in activities that have been funded by the legislature to give us the tools and the toolkit to make that happen, things are getting easier, but we need to push on that goal. As I indicated earlier, I've been a longstanding member of the Association of Minnesota's Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. I know the pushback from county commissioners to stay at that political boundary level, but that can be overcome with education and tools that can be provided by Bowser and the state to increase the motivation to do so. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today, and I appreciate your comments regarding watersheds, because a large part of my area is under the jurisdiction of the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, who is incredibly aggressive to the point of onerous and certain regulations on what they do. It would be nice, or I think it would be productive, to have a better, more uniform approach as opposed to a shotgun approach on how we deal with water management in the state. So I applaud you for going in that direction. And, by the way, good luck with those Hennepin County board members or the rest of the board members of other counties. One question I had regarding buffers, because on Lake Minnetonka we also had an issue with our watershed on buffers. You indicated you had about 1,000 acres enrolled. Was that voluntary or involuntary?
I think so.
Were they voluntary additions to the program, all of them?
These are all – Bowser works exclusively with voluntary buffer programs. Now, on Lake Minnetonka, which is probably similar to Big Sandy Lake where I live, there are requirements in the state shoreland ordinance that require buffers be maintained in the shore impact zone. So the state does have ordinances in place. The state's got the rule, and then counties adopt the ordinances, and then we, through the use of the natural resources block grant dollars provided by the state, enforce those state ordinances. We do have 319 grant money also coming from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, where we are establishing buffer programs on lots that were where the buffer was removed. So today, as it sits, if you have a Minnewawa or Big Sandy Lake or wherever, you have lots that have lost their buffers entirely. It's lawn to lake. You have areas that have buffers maintaining. We have on Big Sandy Lake, and probably in the Minnehaha Watershed District as well, have been utilizing these dollars from the Pollution Control Agency to implement voluntary buffer programs on lakes as well. But the programs I was describing are generally in more rural areas.
Mr. Chair, one concern that I have, and it's something for you to take forward, is that our particular watershed was willing to produce Rule D in the early 2000s and then Rule M very recently. And those rules essentially said if you turn over more than 50 cubic feet, and I can't remember if it's 50, 100, or what the measurement was, but if you turn over by addition to your house, by whatever land activity that takes place, you automatically trigger a automatic 50-foot buffer from the water's edge. And when you're talking about Lake Minnetonka, you're talking about basically losing an entire yard to a buffer situation, whereas I think you need to be aware of certain places where buffers may work and certain places where buffers impinge upon the land rights of the individual. So I would caution you when you move forward in those directions as where you're going in those land rights. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments.
Further questions from the committee? Not. I have a motion. Senator Hoffman moves that Committee on Environment and Energy recommends that the appointment of Brian Napstead, Chair of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, be confirmed by the Senate. Is there any discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, the same with me.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to roll right into the EQB program overview, and I don't know if Bob Patton and Senator Anderson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Patton, and I'm Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. And I will be giving an overview of the Environmental Quality Board, and then I'll be turning things over to Senator Ellen Anderson to talk about the board's implementation of Governor's Executive Order 1132. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. The Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, and you have some handouts that are coming out to give a little background on the board. The board is composed of 9 agency heads and 5 citizen members that are appointed by the governor. And there is a governor's representative who is the chair of the board. Presently, the chair is the Commissioner of Agriculture, David Fredrickson. The board has an overall, if you look at the mission broadly, the mission really is to help set and to coordinate state environmental policy, particularly those issues that are that transcend the traditional boundaries of state governmental agencies. The board was established 40 years ago. It was established at the time of the other major environmental policy initiatives in the state of Minnesota, including the establishment of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. And in fact, one of its big duties over the years has been to administer the state, the Environmental Policy Act, the Environmental Policy Program. So the board writes the rules for that program and provides assistance to all parties, particularly the governmental units that implement the Environmental Review Program, which includes preparation of environmental impact statements. The board has been engaged in major projects over the years. Early in its history, it did a major study of barge fleeting on the Mississippi River. It's done did a study of copper-nickel mining in Minnesota. It's done 2 generic environmental impact statements, one on timber harvest, another on animal agriculture. I almost said urban development. It started a third generic environmental impact statement on urban development as well. More recently, also it was in charge of Governor Carlson's Sustainable Development Initiative in the 90s. More recently, the state, it's in charge of doing state water plans and completed a state water plan in 2010. It's currently working on coordinating the state of a major Corps of Engineers project on water quality in the Minnesota River. It is working on Governor's Executive Order 1132. And right now, it's involved with gathering information and having a discussion on the board on what the state response should be having to do with silica sand mining or frac sand. The board, the staffing component of the board has always been relatively modest, relatively small. At its height, it had, I think, 18 staff and had a full-time executive director. Currently, the staffing component is much smaller. I serve as executive director of the board, but I'm on loan from the Department of Agriculture because there's no funding for an executive director position. We have 2 full-time staff housed at the Pollution Control Agency. And that is our staffing component currently, and we're doing a lot of work with that, including continuing providing service on the Environmental Review Program. Again,
working on the executive order, which Senator Anderson will be talking about presently. So I'm happy to stand for any questions, but I'll turn it over to Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thank
Welcome
you.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. It's very good to see many of my former colleagues and staff here, and it's fun to be here on this side of the table. I currently work for Commissioner Fredrickson, as Bob said, the chair of the EQB and the governor, and one of my major assignments has been to support the work of the EQB in particular, overseeing the Executive Order 1132 in partnership with Bob Patton and others, and doing some other work with the Environmental Quality Board, so a lot of interagency work. So what I'm going to do today is just briefly go through the executive order and talk about that, because that's consumed a major share of the EQB's time and attention over the last year, although there's many other ongoing issues that it spends time on as well. So the executive order, Governor Dayton's executive order 11-32, was signed a year ago, November 2011, and this was the result of some retreats and planning by the new Environmental Quality Board. And the executive order has four main components, and I'll just briefly list those. I'm going to do sort of a quick summary of the pieces of the executive order and give you a progress update. First, the EQB was required to evaluate and make recommendations on how to improve environmental review. Second, the EQB is to evaluate and make recommendations for improved environmental governance and coordination. And that has been scoped to focus primarily on the future of the Environmental Quality Board as an institution. Third, the EQB is tasked with preparing an environment and energy report card. And fourth, the EQB shall organize an environmental congress. So I'll talk about all four of those components briefly and mention the executive order also requires each agency that's part of the EQB, the nine state agencies that are represented on the board, to provide adequate staffing as needed to carry out the requirements of the executive order. And as Bob mentioned, the EQB's actual budget is very, very small, so much of it is donated staff from different agencies that are working together on many of these requirements. So on the executive order, the first project, which is the evaluation and recommendations for improving environmental review, for each part of the executive order, a core team was formed of an interagency core team of staff donated from different agencies. They're, in addition to their regular full-time jobs, they're assigned to this project. So the environmental review team held a series of focus groups with stakeholders around the state to ask their views. They reviewed previous studies on environmental review and published a list of recommendations, which the board approved in November. And I'll just tell you the first three recommendations. There's a number of detailed recommendations, which you can find on the EQB website. The first one is to strengthen the EQB's capacity for oversight and assistance in implementation of environmental review. And the idea is to have a stronger role in oversight and continuous improvement of our environmental review process and outcomes. The second priority was to develop a better system of making information available. And so this recommendation involves the idea of creating a web-based portal where all the documentation related to environmental review processes underway will be housed in one central web portal on the EQB website. And this will have a number of really valuable results, including more transparent information, but also the ability to avoid costly delays because everyone has access to the same information right away, and to provide better outcomes so that you really can have a way of, we talked about this in our silica sand discussion yesterday in the board meeting, this will be a way to look at cumulative impacts of different projects in a region, for example. So one of the other, the third recommendation or third priority was to expand the use of alternative urban area-wide review, which is something Bob can talk about in more detail if you're interested, and some other specific recommendations related to EAWs and other detailed environmental review processes. So that's all I'll say about that section for now, unless there's questions later. The second project under the executive order was to review environmental governance and coordination. And the EQB ended up recommending, after looking at a series of different options, recommending that the EQB should indeed be revitalized and refocused, because it has sort of been slowly defunded and a lot of its authority, it hasn't been able to fulfill a lot of its statutory authority as a result over the last number of years. So the three priorities that the EQB is recommending for the new improved EQB to focus on would be strategic planning and interagency coordination on environmental policy issues. And there are many key issues that really do cut across different agency jurisdictions, and this is a forum to have those coordinated, to eliminate duplication, and to have more coherent and cohesive planning across the administration. Secondly, the very important role of environmental review oversight and improvement. And thirdly, public access to environmental review information. So these recommendations, to a certain extent, overlap some of the environmental review recommendations. And the third recommendation for governance is to adequately resource the EQB to be able to provide those goals and be able to really function as intended in those areas, which is really almost impossible to do with the current staffing levels. So there's other specific recommendations, but I won't go into any more detail on that, trying to be brief here. So let me jump ahead to the third and fourth parts, which you probably have heard about. One is the preparation of the Environment and Energy Report Card, which I think you've all been handed your copy of. And this is, again, the product of an interagency team, and a lot of technical staff from different agencies participated in sharing information to put this together. And so it's sort of like the PCA's dashboard, but it cuts across five general topic areas of air, water, land, energy, and climate. It's intended to be a baseline to show us how the state of Minnesota is doing in these areas, and wherever possible to show what the goals are that we have in place under current law or regulation, and how we're doing, what the trends are towards the future, and how we're what direction we're moving in these areas. The executive order requires that the report card be updated annually. So we've actually taken a lot of comments about the report card, and I just want to clarify that it's intended to be updated every year, and all of those comments that we've received will be taken into consideration when we do the next version sometime in the following this year. And there are copies available. Finally, the Environmental Congress is the fourth project that the EQB was required to do by the executive order. And I should point out that the original statutes, the original EQB statutes that Bob mentioned that were passed in the 1970s, actually say that the EQB should regularly do an Environmental Congress and do a report card. But it hasn't happened since 1994 was the last time that there was an Environmental Congress held under the leadership of the Environmental Quality Board. So we really are trying to do some of the core missions that have been left behind in recent years. So the Congress, the EQB set up a plan to do the Congress, and they wanted to start it by reaching out to citizens around the state and find out what they think about critical environmental and energy issues. And that's why we set up six citizen forums around the state, which many of you have attended. And I know other legislators have been at those, and many, many of your constituents. The forums were held in Rochester, Duluth, Bloomington, Moorhead, St. Cloud, and Worthington. So we traveled around the state in November and December, and we're really quite stunned at the turnout that we received. We had planned for about 100 people to show up at each forum, and our turnout was roughly double that overall, because we ended up with over 1,200 Minnesotans participating in this process. So that was really an exciting result, and I think in large part, there was a couple reasons for that. I would say that the agencies did a fantastic job, I think, of trying to reach out to their stakeholder lists, and we sent out from different state agencies more than 20,000 email invitations, and many outside groups also recruited their members and their constituencies, farm groups, environmental groups, et cetera, reached out to their constituencies, political groups, to try to get people to attend the forum. So we tried very, very hard to reach out to all different sectors as required by statute, by EQB statutes, including agriculture, conservation and environmental groups, mining and energy, forestry, chambers of commerce, local governments, elected officials at all levels, tribal governments, and colleges and universities. And we know that representatives of all these groups were there participating. We've gotten a great deal of very positive feedback about it, which has been really gratifying. And many commissioners and public members of the EQB board participated in every forum. So it was a really unique opportunity for citizens to have one-on-one contact with state leaders. At the forums, I'll just talk a little bit about the results and then a brief description of what we plan for the statewide Congress in March, and then I'll be done. We started with a presentation of the report card at the forums, and then we asked people their views about different issues. And I would say just a quick summary of the top issues that we heard people talking about were silica sand mining, copper nickel mining, water quality and groundwater depletion, climate change and energy, and wolf hunting. And we also heard some general themes that cut across different issue areas. The need for regulation to be based on sound science. We heard that over and over. The need for more education on environmental issues. And the need for the jobs and the economy to be balanced with environmental protection. So those were common themes across Minnesota and from all different people. We did some quick polling with clickers, which people really liked, and it allowed the crowd that we had in the room to immediately register their views on different issues. And I'll just give you a few of those quick summary of results. We found out that a majority of the participants were over age 45. We had a little bit of a demographic bubble there, and we're working very hard to reach out to younger Minnesotans and sort of the next generation component for our statewide Congress in March. So we have a real representative group. Top priorities for water included non-point and stormwater runoff along with invasive species. We ask about priorities for land as our state adds a million more people projected by 2030. In every forum, the top priority was to encourage people to live in already developed areas. We ask about priorities for non-point air pollution, and at every forum, the top priority picked was to improve vehicle efficiency as a strategy. And there were a lot of other choices that were selected as well. I'm just giving you some of the top vote getters. And in terms of renewable energy, we asked how much renewable energy we should have in our state by 2050, and the largest group at every forum selected as much as possible, and a majority across the state want at least 50% of our energy to come from renewable sources by 2050. That was a pretty strong result. And the top priority in every forum for meeting our greenhouse gas goals was to invest in technology to save energy. This is not a scientific poll by any means, but it was instructive and interesting. So quickly, the follow-up plan. We have staff working to compile all the pages and pages of notes that we have from all of our discussion groups, all the comment cards, the written comments, and all the online comments we've received at the forum. So we'll have a lot more of a detailed report once we have all that data transcribed and organized. We will post that online for anyone to see, and there will be a follow-up report on the themes and lessons learned from these forums at the statewide forum, or statewide Congress. So finally, the statewide Environmental Congress is scheduled for March 15th in Bloomington, and this is intended not to be another of the seventh forum, but to be the next step in the process, which is to really engage knowledgeable citizen leaders and experts to come together and synthesize and react to what we learned at the citizen forums from Minnesotans, and to use that as a stepping-off point to articulate a vision for Minnesota's environment and energy future and action items that they can recommend to the Environmental Quality Board. And again, the statute requires broad participation. We intend to reach out to a broad and diverse group of Minnesotans to participate in this. And we're working now on developing the program that will hopefully bring in experts responding to the report card and the forums, have significant dialogue, and make sure we have a way for the broader public to follow and comment on the results. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for your attention. We'd both be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for this report. I really appreciate that. I appreciate getting the date of the Congress that's coming up, and I applaud Governor Dayton for issuing his executive order because, as we've seen in the 3/8 clean water heritage money that Minnesotans decided to tax themselves because they feel so strongly about clean water and air. And I think that this is a major undertaking, and I think it's something that should be ongoing. I've often wondered why the EQB had gone down in numbers so drastically in the years, and I can't believe that we had 18 staff at one time for the good work that you do. It's the one way that citizens, I believe, really have input, and I'm so looking forward to your comment process. I just had a question. When was it that we had 18 staff doing this work, coordinating the agencies to get rid of duplication?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi. I believe that was in the late 80s, early 90s. The big staff change happened when the energy facility siting program was separated from the Environmental Quality Board. Environmental Quality Board used to do all the transmission line routing and siting of power plants and all that up until 2005, and that was transferred then, including staff, to the Department of Commerce. So that reduced staff down to, I think, 6 at that time.
And then also
from probably 14 or so, 16 maybe.
Mr. Chair, just to add, Senator, the Minnesota Planning basically was eliminated along the way, too.
Yes, that
and
was
that eliminated some staffing that supported the EQB's work more on strategic planning.
Senator Scalzi.
Just as a follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then when the staff was sent to the Department of Commerce, did they continue that work or not?
That staff continued that work. It was transferred to the Department of Commerce, which supports the work of the Public Utilities Commission on those issues.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here today. As we look at the 6 locations around the state that you held the public meetings, when you're summarizing that data, will you show a summary for each site, or will it be compiled as one group?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. Senator, I think we're going to have some regional data pulled out because people are very curious to see what their own area had to say. But we'll also have cumulative data.
And I think that's what I was getting at, is if trying to figure out which items are top priority in each respective area.
Absolutely, Mr. Yeah. Chair and Senator. That was a high priority for the board to make sure that we had some sense of regional priorities.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, then Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. It's exciting to see when you get the comprehensive coordination of agencies going across jurisdictions to get work done. And knowing what I know about the EQB, there's tech reps that serve as liaisons between the EQB, Environmental Quality Board, and the, I'll not use acronyms, and the different agencies there. And it looks to me like you only have 3 people working, Mr. Patton and then a couple of other folks. Is first of all, is that correct? And then secondly, how do you envision these tech reps, and what do you see them, what are they doing as currently staffing or not staffing the agency? I'm looking for a need.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, you're exactly right. The EQB really operates with a staff of its own, but also really relies on the tech reps, the technical representatives of the 9 agencies that are on the board. And so the tech reps are an integral part of each meeting of the board. Before the board meets, the technical representatives have a meeting to talk about the issues that are before the board. They serve then to brief their own commissioners on the issues that are coming up, and then they do a whale of a lot of work, depending on what the workload is of the board. Often serve on interagency committees and work tasks. For example, with the executive order, the tech reps were a large part of the staffing component for implementing the executive order. I hope that answered your question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It does, and it just leads to one more follow-up, which is you really – the reliance on them is, it seems to me, isn't for the day-to-day activities that the board would be doing, but rather the group that – when the board's going to meet prior to. And so that still leaves a gap. At least it seems there's a gap in the day-to-day activities that are there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, you're correct, although the board has always quite a bit relied on essentially contributions donations is probably not the proper word, but active participation of the member agencies by staff in often in the various specialty areas that are being dealt with by the board. So there's typically over the years been a lot of staff task force and groups that have worked on various issues over the years. So there's always been a kind of a larger staffing component of agency staff contributing to Environmental Quality Board efforts. I hope that helps.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I didn't catch the date of the March Congress. What was that again?
March 15th, all right. Mr. Chair.
Thanks. And I just wanted to ask, kind of popping in and out of the room because I had another meeting over in that corner of the building, so I had to kind of be over there. I wanted to ask a little bit more about these meetings you had last year. If you can just remind me, I know you presented, but how many were they, where were they, and how many folks showed up? And then I had a follow-up question.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, there were six meetings starting in Rochester, Duluth, Bloomington, Worthington, Moorhead, and St. Cloud. So it was over the course of a couple, 2.5 weeks. And the attendance varied from city to city. So in Rochester, we had a standing room only crowd of around 200 and some. In Bloomington, we had well over 400. And in the other cities, somewhere between 70, I guess, in Worthington, up to 200 some in all the other cities. So about 1,200 total is a rough estimate. We did have to rely on many, many staff from different agencies to help facilitate those meetings. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
The first question?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it seems like these meetings were oversubscribed, much more popular than you anticipated, which I think is a good thing. It's a good problem. Do you draw any lessons about or have any idea as to why? And part of my second question was about other agencies. I think other agencies maybe struggle with that level of community participation and engagement when they're going out for input and feedback on some pretty important initiatives of theirs. They're doing their long-range planning documents or doing some of the undertaking those activities. Are you planning to maybe draw some of those lessons and help other agencies understand why some of those meetings were so well attended and had so much energy?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's I can speculate about it. Maybe Mr. Patton has other thoughts too, but I think we did hear from lots of people around the state how excited they were to have this opportunity to talk about these issues. There seemed to be a real pent-up demand to have state leaders asking them these questions about environmental issues. That was what a lot of people told us. And to have leaders there in the room with them, commissioners and EQB board members, I think was really important as well. So it wasn't just talking to other staff, it was talking to decision makers who represented a big part of Governor Dayton's cabinet. That was significant. And we did hear from a number of agency staff who were quite envious, and they said, we don't get turnout like this at our meetings. So Beyond that, I'm not quite sure, but I think there's just a great deal of interest in the issues presented, and people loved being asked their opinion. Anything you would add?
No, that really captures it.
So, Mr. Chair, is maybe one of the key ingredients the presence of commissioner-level staff there, commissioner-level and folks who report directly to the commissioner, that people who can make decisions being present, available in the room? Is that a lesson we can draw?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that was really important, and that helped attract large crowds of people.
Thank you.
Who is invited to the Environmental Congress? I mean, is public at large? I mean, how do you, I mean, I don't know how many people you're expecting.
Well, we're in the process, Mr. Chair, of determining that. And the EQB, we had a monthly board meeting yesterday, and the EQB has directed that they want, as I mentioned, not to have this be another forum-like event, but to have it be a little bit smaller audience, perhaps, of selected leaders and experts. So perhaps we will, well, we're asking board members are coming up with lists of organizations they think need to be represented. And again, that's across all different sectors that I mentioned. That includes business, environmental groups, government, tribal governments, colleges and universities, et cetera. So a really broad spectrum of people need to be represented, and it needs to be representative of Minnesotans. But I think the idea is to have it be leaders and some real experts. We have a lot of expertise in our state, and let them digest what the citizens had to say at large so that we can use that to formulate some higher, you know, refine and prioritize all the different input that we got at the forums. With 1,200 people, lots and lots of ideas were laid on the table. And the EQB wants to be able to use this information to really take action and to really create some kind of a blueprint for moving forward now and into the future. And so they just want a sort of a higher, I don't want to use the word higher level, a group of experts to really review this information and give their thoughts. But there's a big public expectation. Mm-hmm. There's a big groundwell of interest because of the forums, because of the excitement generated by the forums. And so we want to make sure that there's a way for the public to weigh in and to continue to have a voice in this process. So we're working on trying to figure out that balance. So stay tuned.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Harris.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Patton and Madam or Senator Adamson. Yeah. I just wonder how the city are chosen for the forum site for EQB, and I noticed that Twin City or St. Paul are more like the melting pot community, you know, of our state, and, you know, I'm just kind of curious why it's not there.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, perhaps let me take a shot at that first. It was a tough choice to select the sites because we, with the very limited resources we had to be able to do these, we had to narrow it down to a half a dozen places. And there was a strong desire from the board to go out to greater Minnesota to make sure that we had some geographic diversity. So there was a lot of discussion over what cities to choose. The Twin Cities was represented, of course, in the Bloomington Forum. And then the others were really supposed to be, you know, chosen as major media markets for the state, and that was really the reason those particular sites were chosen. But it was a tough choice. We would have loved to have gone to many more places.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's exactly right. And I think if we had more resources, more staff, and more time, we heard a lot of people from the Twin Cities ask that we have a meeting in the city itself. We heard that a lot from the north central part of the state, the Lakes region around Brainerd. That, and I think in a sense it's a good problem to have. We know there's a lot more interest And so we apologize for those who weren't able to attend. I think the fact that we had well over 400 people in Bloomington was reassuring that a lot of people found their way there. But we want to make sure that we engage voices that are well represented in Minneapolis and St. Paul as we go through this process. So we'd love your suggestions for people that you think would be important people to participate in the Congress on March 15th so that we'd be sure that we are representing all parts of the state really, really well and all our populations very well. That would be really helpful.
Senator Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, I wasn't real clear on your response. For the Environmental Congress, is the public going to be invited? That decision hasn't been made yet. They're not going to be invited. How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say we're still in the planning phase, so we'll be making a decision and letting you know very, very soon. I guess I can't really answer it. It's the challenge and the beauty of interagency leadership is that we have a lot of decision makers, and we're trying to find a consensus that everyone can support. So we'll let you know very, very soon.
Further questions from the committee? We'll move on to next. Well, one more quick one. You mentioned earlier the environmental review. You're supposed to look at the environmental review process. Are you making recommendations on that at some point?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, we do have some recommendations that I just briefly mentioned, and the EQB did approve a list of recommendations and an entire report based that surrounds that, and that was sent to the governor, and those can all be found on the EQB website.
Thank you both very much. And
thank you.
For members of the committee, there are more of these report cards over there on the card if you're interested.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. We'll move to the MPCA, Assistant Commissioner Janelka. And I'm not sure we're running a little behind time, so I think we'll try and get to both you and the DNR if we have a chance yet.
Chairman. You need a second here to move the...
Set up for you. Members. My name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for Legislative and Land Policy. Thanks for the opportunity today to provide a short overview of the agency. This will be a quick overview of nuts and bolts of the organization and spend a little bit more time on the PCA programs, including our challenges and some of our successes. Real quickly, I just want to highlight the agency's mission in a nutshell. It is to protect public health and the environment. I'd also like to highlight one of the handouts in your packet, which is our leadership breakdowns. The agency is a matrix organization, so each of the MPCA's major media programs involve the work of more than one operational division. It was created this way in 1998. The structure was designed to be interdependent. Each division is reliant on each other so we don't form silos of air, land, and water policy. So many times when folks look at our org chart, they ask, where is the air, land, and water policy groups? This way of organization is an acknowledgement that the environmental problems of today are more complex than all types of media. Look at a permit or any type of environmental review. So I'm not going to bore you with the details of the sheet, but as you can see, it just basically has Assistant Commissioner that has oversight of that policy area that are involved, and then also the one of the seven programs the agency has. The MPCA is unique in another way. It's governed by a citizen board chaired by the MPCA commissioner. This is unique to state government and other agencies of our size. Much of the agency work, however, does not go through the board. It's a day-to-day operation that's delegated to the commissioner and the staff. The board provides public decision-making on controversial regulatory issues and on environmental review. Just to give you a quick sample of the work split, the number of projects that went before the board in 2012 was 12. Also, some additional were reviewed by the board, some of our rulemaking and our regional phase SIP, which is a much smaller universe of the 3,000 to 5,000 permits we get a year. Prior to this change in the 90s, all permits went to the board. So the board would be presented with a slate of permits or decisions that needed to be made once. Much of the MPCA's work is delegated from the federal government through our federal authority. Here is just a sample of the list of various programs we are delegated to implement here in Minnesota. In this fashion, we represent the federal government, offer the permitting requirement, offer permits regulated industries for the federal government. Federal government EPA must also then have oversight, so at times they can come in and review or change our. We must continue to meet federal standards, and the, as I mentioned, the federal government does audit the MPCA. While I know this isn't a budget committee, I did just want to answer the question of how the MPCA is funded. As you can see, a very small part of our revenue is, or our resources are from the general. It comes from the Environmental and Remediation Fund, which comes from a collection of the solid waste tax, air and land and water fees, along with portion of the Petrofund receipts for cleanup. Those are some of our larger funding sources. It's just a quick slide of how that breaks down into our media areas, since most of the work we do is in that way. As the commissioner mentioned earlier, we use a series of metrics to keep track of our progress towards environmental goals. Our dashboard is just a handful of those that we. The dashboard is also available on our website at this location, and as mentioned, we update them. So if you don't see your particular metric that you're interested in, it doesn't mean we aren't tracking it or monitoring it. It just hasn't made it to the dashboard, and we can supply that information. Our programs regularly use this information during our strategic planning. Next, I'd like to just go through our major media areas and highlight a few of the things our 900-plus employees think about daily. Build on some of the things our commissioner mentioned about the successes and challenges before the agency. First is air quality programs. As I mentioned, the agency has plans developed every 5 years, and for each of our media areas, we have a vision and a number of objectives and goals underneath it. Right now, we're at the very tail end of our current plan, which will be up in a couple months. This is what guides our work. So when we look at the drive, this chart is a really talks about the drivers of air pollution in Minnesota. As you can see, vehicle miles traveled, energy consumption, along with real gross state product has been increasing over the last 20 so years. At the same time, the bottom blue line there, you can see that emissions as a whole have decreased during that same time. But it leads to the question of, is our air MPCA monitors fine particulate matter and also ground-level ozone and compares them to the federal standards, which are set to protect public health. As you can see here, these are the two areas where we're the closest to federal standards. Overall, while air pollution levels in Minnesota have improved during the last several decades, these standards have been tightened over the same time to reflect new knowledge of how these pollutants affect our health. This slide breaks further down the sources of these pollutants. This is a slide from our MinRisk tool, which is a modeling tool we use to identify specific pollutants and the risks they pose to public health. As you can see, on the upper left-hand side there, the large regulated permitted facilities, we call them point sources, or what most folks will see is the smokestacks on the horizon, pose a significantly less health risk than the point sources. And this is in part where our challenge is. Arise. The point sources, whether they're area or on or off road, whether it's our lawnmower, The furnace systems we heat our homes or our vehicles contribute a large number of the air pollutants that we're required to task, which takes a different set of tools to tackle. The regulatory permit system doesn't work in these areas. Here we have to work on technical assistance, financial assistance, along with education and outreach to get voluntary changes. And these are some of the highlights of the air quality changes that we as an agency are seeing over the next couple of years. I just want to highlight one of them, the first one there, the new federal air quality standards. EPA recently changed the fine particulate matter standard, PM 2.5, and is in the process of changing the ozone standard, hopefully, what we expect to be in 2014. From our understanding of where the ozone standard could be set, it's on the bottom range of where they're looking at. State could go into non-attainment. This is a concern for multiple reasons. One, violating the standards means that there's larger impacts to public health, which is part of our mission is to protect the public. Two, it also puts the state in a different regulatory system, which has a significant impact on business and what can be done in our permitting structures. It's also why you see a diverse group of people come together under the Clean Air Dialogue, such as the Chamber, Minnesota Center for Environmental and us to find a solution to this so we can build that cushion to stay within the federal standards. Next issue I'd like to highlight is land and waste. Instead of just boring you with slides, I do want to show a little bit of a video here of some of the work we do in this area. Maybe not. Just a second here, sorry. Here is the Hopkins landfill. The land program has realized a number of successes. To date, more than 17,472 of the petroleum remediation sites have been cleaned up. That includes 269 of the 306 Superfund and closed landfill sites have been remediated. This example here is the Hopkins landfill is one of the projects currently underway. This site was an open city dump in the 1950s, in the days before there were rules against such things. In the 70s, the MPCA worked with the community, like Hopkins, to deal with the problem, either to close them or make them a sanitary landfill. The Hopkins landfill was permitted in 71 and then closed in 1980. In short, it took 30 years to fill this parcel of land with residential trash. In about 3 months over the summer, contractors reduced the pile by more than a third, and in the summer of 2013, we expect to place the final cover and complete the project. As you'll see here, the Hopkins landfill is an atypical site because homes are located so close, sometimes within 50 feet of waste. Its proximity to nearby residential properties is what made it number one on the state's closed landfill priority list. There were methane detections in some of the lower levels of the townhomes in the 1980s, and in 1990-91, a passive barrier was installed along the east and southern edge of the homes by the city, which was fairly successful. To reduce the risk to the public and the environment, this project, when completed, will have moved about 310,000 cubic yards of waste from the edge to the middle of the pile, reducing the footprint of the landfill from 26 to 18 acres, and replace the active gas extraction system to increase efficiency and better control landfill gas mitigation. In addition, an improved surface water drainage at the site will be realized, and the installation of two passive vents to vent an existing methane pocket there. This is an example here of some of the work the commissioner mentioned on closing out landfills in our program that needed major construction to protect the public health and the environment. The next challenge I'd like to just talk a little bit about, which you mentioned, is solid waste. This metric here talks about the solid waste in the state. As you can see, over the last 10 years, recycling has stayed stagnant. Under the state law, there are a number of priorities set where we must first look at recycling, composting before sending the leftover municipal waste, the waste energy, or to landfill. As the commissioner mentioned, our studies show about 70% of the waste landfill could be recycled or composted. This is a lost opportunity because of the 1.3 million tons of recyclable materials that are going into waste energy facilities or being landfilled, 312 million or of it could be, it's worth $312 million. To add salt to that wound, it's costing us $200 million to dispose of it. This is a lost opportunity in jobs. There are a number of companies in the state, for instance, Goodall Steel and St. Paul, that use recycled materials in a new product. There are companies such as Plastic Lumber Companies in Painesville and egg carton companies in Moorhead. So they're all across the state. There are 37,000 plus recycling jobs as a result, which contributes nearly $2 billion in wages to the state. If we could realize what's going into these landfills and waste energy facilities, we could increase that greatly. But here are just, again, some of the challenges we're facing on the land and waste areas. Next, I'm just going to turn to water quality, our vision statement again. This here is our watershed circle of life, we like to call it. Over the last few years, the agency's changed how it's dealt with its water quality monitoring and restoration efforts. We've improved the science of assessing and protecting and restoring our watersheds. We've moved to a more systematic approach that allows us to target our efforts and get the most of each of our dollars and work on multiple pollutants at the same time. As you can see, this is a with the Clean Water Fund, we're now on a 10-year cycle to assess each of the state's watersheds. What the process starts with is we do the watershed testing, move on to interpreting those results through mapping and modeling to devise what we need to do, devise cleanup plans, restoration plans, or protection plans where waters aren't impaired, which is part of the process, designating for EPA waters that are impaired. This then will dictate how we at the agency operate our regulatory programs and help our sister water agencies when they help on voluntary actions, such as balls are targeting dollars towards efforts, whether it's urban or storm runoff. And then at that 10-year cycle, at the end of it, we go back through to measure our results, see if we did what we wanted to do, if it worked, and if we are falling short, what needs still to be done so that we can change what we were doing previously and not keep doing the same thing which may have been wrong. I'm going to go back to the video here just to highlight some of our successes when it comes to the water area. This year, for 3 weeks this summer, as the commissioner mentioned, PCA staff monitored a 20-mile stretch of Minnesota River to see if the hot, dry summer caused low dissolved oxygen levels. Low levels in the past caused problems for aquatic life, rivers at low flow, and water temperatures are high. Results show that the dissolved oxygen levels are good and support fish and other aquatic life even during stressed. I apologize, this is running slow here.
Looks like the boat's going to tip over.
That are stressed conditions. These results point to the effectiveness. The effectiveness of a 2004 MPCA phosphorus reduction strategy that were implemented by wastewater treatment facilities along the Minnesota River and its tributaries. The reduction goals set forth in the basin permits are approximately 3 years ahead of schedule. While this is great news for the regulated community, unregulated sources of phosphorus are not decreasing as quickly. Apologize for the delay here. Just want to get to a portion here, an example of an outlet to show what this has meant to the river. I'm just going to scrap this. I apologize. What we did have next was a video from our Met Council Blue Lake wastewater treatment plant outfall located in Shakopee. What you would have seen as the camera is lowered by the outfall, you can see the relatively clear water. And as the camera pulls away into the water, you see the camera veers away from the outfall and notices the water clarity decreases. It's an example of how these point sources have done their job very well, and it's other contributors to the system that is really still the impact we need to make on water. On our website also, which is what the next video is going to be, we do show pictures of runoff from agricultural fields and urban stormwater, the pollutants that are a major challenge to the water protections and restoration efforts. What I'd hope to show were images of a farm field in southeast Minnesota during an early spring rain event. You'll see the field lacked any type of vegetative cover or crop residue, and the water flows directly off of it into a culvert and into the river. And you can tell the color is very distinctly brown from the loss of soil. 2 weeks later, when it's dried out, we show two pictures of two different fields side by side. One, again, the same field, dried out, and the wind is easily whipping away the topsoil. And on the other side, on the same day by comparison, a field with corn residue stubble still there, not experiencing any of the erosion. To illustrate the simple changes that can be made that have large differences. Also, urban stormwater also carries many pollutants. Storm sewers typically flow directly to rivers and streams without passing through any type of treatment. Storm and ag runoff present these unique challenges. And while there are some regulations, much of the successful mitigation of these pollutants will depend on voluntary individual actions and implementation of best management practices. The success story of the Minnesota River at low flow and the challenges point urban rural runoff are similar in other ways. The cleanup of the wastewater plants was seen as an insurmountable task, but it was achieved ahead of schedule. The video showed examples of a field where a farmer implemented protective changes. They and others like them should be given credit for their efforts, but our task now is to accelerate the adoption of these practices and management practices by even more landowners. Today that may seem insurmountable, but it too is not. And this is where the Ag Water Quality Certification Program that's being led by Department of Ag comes into play. Again, here are just some of the water challenges we as an agency see we'll be facing in the upcoming. The last area is assistance and operations. And this is some of our multimedia programs, our assistant programs, but also the general operations of what make our agency run. 2002 and 2003, the agency installed a strong continuous improvement philosophy by implementing processes such as Six Sigma, Lean, and others that have created systematic and not random acts of improvement that relied on data to make decisions and customers' input. These tools we've been using successfully in many areas, and one of them is a priority outlined by the legislature and the governor to permit environmental review efficiency. We've been working hard in this area, and we've been able to issue nearly 97% of our priority permits, which are construction or expansion. These are the permits which mean jobs. Without these permissions, these companies couldn't get moving. Overall, though, that leaves 84% of all of our other permits. We do put a priority on, like I said, the construction permits and set renewal of permits back and get to them as we can, steadily moving on them. While a permit may expire and need to be renewed, the environmental protections are still there. A permittee still has to follow the requirements in the permit in addition to any new federal changes that are there. This still gives the company the protection it needs to continue to operate so there's no stoppages. As I mentioned, our strong continuous improvement philosophy, we did institute a three-day Kaizen event, which is identified in our next priorities, which includes e-applications for simpler projects that are low-risk based. For instance, we have used for construction stormwater, we use a processing application that issues general permits within 7 days. We're looking now for other general permits or registration permits that could be done in a similar fashion so that we can those that are more cookie-cutter and low-risk, we can move along quickly through this system and spend our resources on those individualized, complex, controversial projects which need additional attention. Finally, just an example of some of our assistance programs. The diesel retrofit program is an example of one of our financial assistance partnerships with MEI and the fleet industry. As you can see, not only did we reduce the environmental impacts, but save fleet owners money. Some of the examples that show likewise results environmentally and monetarily are RETAP and MINTAP program, which sends out experts in the field to companies as they request a voluntary program to help them with energy efficiency, water conservation, and others that result in direct environmental benefits or monetary benefits. And finally, here are some of the major assistance and operation challenges we see. Point you towards that last bullet. The commissioner mentioned our efforts to modernize our databases and also our permitting systems to create a smart system. Thank you again for your time. I just wanted to highlight the contact information for myself and Catherine Neuschler, who are the legislative team for the MPCA. If you have any questions on legislation, specific constituent concerns, or others, please feel free to contact us.
Thank you. And with that, unless there are pressing questions from the committee, I'd like to see if Mr. Meyer can do his report real quickly as well. Are there any questions people really? Okay, thank you. Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee. You have about 18 minutes, I guess, 20 minutes.
I do have some handouts here.
We'll get them distributed. Just go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. My official title is Director of Policy and Government Relations. I spend most of my time here in session with you all, the House and Senate, and probably driving back and forth to our offices over on 500 Lafayette. Thank you for the opportunity just to provide you a brief overview of the DNR and what we do and how we do it. You'll see on this slide it talks about our missions and goals. The DNR's mission statement, just to kind of paraphrase, is we work with the citizens of the state of Minnesota to manage the state's natural resources, provide for outdoor recreational opportunities, and provide for sustainable commercial uses of our natural resources in ways that create a sustainable quality of life. Some folks refer to it as timber, taconite, tourism. There's a lot more to it than that, but we do have a lot of things that we need to make sure are working in conjunction with each other. A good way that we like to talk about it, and just kind of a graphical way to think about it, is these three circles talk about the three pieces of our mission statement, and in the center it represents the DNR. We need to kind of focus in the middle, maintaining all three of these attributes of our mission statement in order to be most successful most of the time, but sometimes we need to make sure we're protecting natural resources in a way that may protect or prohibit certain activities, outdoor recreation, for example. We have scientific and natural areas that do not allow any motorized use. We need to protect the rare plants and animals that are on those areas. And also the economic development is a very important piece as we look at outstate Minnesota, particularly in the timber area of the state and where the mining activities occur. One of our key goals is to make sure that we're an adaptive and a fluid type of agency, and we do that through performance management systems. This document or this graphic here outlines how we take upon this kind of, I don't want to say in a biennial fashion, but almost in a daily fashion as we look at things that we're dealing with. We plan, we budget, of course, we work with the legislature and stakeholders to deal with that. We measure that plan or what we're doing, our activities, and then we adapt to make sure that we're doing it in the most effective and efficient ways. And inside of that, we're making sure that we're operating within our missions and goals, our agency strategies and actions, our budget objectives, and just evaluating constantly to make sure that we're doing the best we can with the resources that we can, but also to protect the state's environment and natural resources. To do this, Commissioner Landwehr, upon his appointment, created a kind of a working document or a framework for the department. It's called Conservation That Works, and here you can see some folks doing a little bit of electric shocking in a brook trout stream. Conservation That Works is a strategic document that we're using right now that helps set departmental plans and sets the direction and establishes key actions for the coming years. It's made up of goals and strategies that work to promote our conservation, economic development, recreational opportunities. I'm not going to go into all of those pieces right now, but if you're interested, we can certainly provide you a copy with the full document. The plan consists of four major goals, 25 four-year strategies, and 100 different key action items that we're continually monitoring for progress and as we talked about in our performance management diagram, making sure that they're being adapted and functioning the way that they're supposed to be. Goal one is to protect Minnesota's waters, natural lands, and diverse fish and wildlife habitats will be conserved and enhanced. And you can see at the bottom of this slide, it's a little bit hard to read, and I apologize for that, but a full circle means that we have high progress today, a half circle is moderate, and just a hollow circle is that we're having low progress today. And a couple of the key ones here, prevent the curb spread of invasive species. It's moderate action right now. It's a function of funding and behavioral change and actually just trying to get ahead of the curve and working with stakeholders and local units of government to continue that fight. Accelerating and better target prairie grassland landscape conservation is very low. There's some challenges there that focus around land ownership funding and just activities we can do, and also enhance lake, river, and stream aquifer and aquatic habitat work. There's moderate, but we're working very hard to make sure that we can achieve those goals. Goal number two deals with outdoor recreation opportunities and making sure that we're meeting the needs of new and existing participants so that all feel connected to nature. This is a picture of our I Can Camp program at one of our state parks. Working with our non-traditional stakeholders or expanding the use, getting people into the park system is one of our key goals. And you can see here, maintaining and enhancing our high-quality outdoor recreation system and focusing on engaging families and youth are a couple of our key components of this, trying to get people into parks. And you know, one of the big things we heard is that people were afraid to go camping because they didn't know how to set up a tent or start a fire or that they might get attacked by wild animals, things like that. So we provide this program to have people there to set up a tent for them, show them how to start a fire, people next door in the campground to help them. It's been very, very successful, and working with these stakeholders to get people into the parks is a key priority. If other businesses use buses to bring them to their locations, we probably should have buses that bring people to state parks at some times as well. So making people into the park system is something that's really important to us. Goal three, talking about the management of Minnesota's natural resources that contribute to strong and sustainable job markets, economies, and communities. It's been a struggle on some of these things, just real frankly. Expanding approaches to achieve conservation objectives and economic uses of lands. We're working very closely with our stakeholders and our businesses to do that. There's a lot of interest in doing that. Developing new models for school trust fund land management is a very high priority for us. This is a key thing last session. It has been for the department for some time, but we're continuing to work on school trust land management. New models for forest management is something we'll be talking about as we talk about forest management policy this coming session. But we've achieved some great strides there. And then just responsible development and managing of our mineral resources. We feel we're doing a very proactive job on those as well. Goal four, talking about operational excellence and a focus on continuous improvement and service to its conservation mission. We've been very successful in these, and this is a huge part of our mission statement, not really related stated in it, but internally, continuous improvement and performance measurement is just very important to us. Improving efficiency of DNR business practices and adoption of best science and management principles and practices in all of our daily activities is something Commissioner Landwehr takes very important, and it's a high priority for us. This map, you can see it a little bit, but we kind of touch every corner of the state, almost every county. We have over 180 offices. This talks about our, it shows our regions, our work sites, and our facilities. And the regions kind of don't show up here very well, but we have four regions within the state. Region 1 offices, the headquarters are in Bemidji, and it kind of covers this whole area here, the northwestern part of the state. Region 2, we're in Grand Rapids. Basically from Crow Wing up, the Arrowhead region. Region 3 covers basically from almost to south of Brainerd all the way down along the Mississippi River. We've established that because of the impact of the Mississippi River in that region. And then Region 4 is our southwest region. So we have headquarters there, regional management teams, and then we have division offices and interagency offices located throughout the state. Spend a lot of money heating and cooling those facilities, but energy efficiency is something we take very seriously, and the less we can spend on heating and cooling while keeping our staff and customers in a comfortable location, we don't want to freeze anybody out or sweat them out of the office, that's more money we can spend on our conservation mission. So conservation and energy efficiency is very important to us. This slide just shows a brief high-level overview of our organizational structure. The commissioner's office, and then we have three assistant commissioners and myself who are in the commissioner's office. Two assistant commissioners oversee, Assistant Commissioner Mary McConnell oversees our Lands and Minerals, Forestry, and Ecological Water Resources Division. Assistant Commissioner Erica Rivers oversees Fish and Wildlife, Parks and Trails, and Enforcement. And actually, Deputy Director David Shad oversees our Operations Supports Division. And we have an Assistant Commissioner Mike Carroll, who is actually located in outstate Minnesota office in Park Rapids that deals with our outstate organizational constituent contacts and oversees our four regional directors. This is just a slide that shows our division directors and who they are. You will be meeting these folks as we talk about specific issues related to their divisions, and we'll also be meeting with you one-on-one to deal with any specific questions or concerns you may have related to their divisions. Colonel Jim Conrad, the director of our Enforcement Division. Steve Hirsch, director of Ecological and Water Resources. Ed Bogus for Fish and Wildlife. Forrest Bowe for Forestry. Jess Richards from Lands and Minerals. Cortland Nelson, Parks and Trails. And Lori Martinson, Operational Support. Just quickly, I'm going to go through each division. I have a couple slides. And one thing I'm going to talk about very briefly, you'll see a picture of a pie chart that talks about funding, because funding does drive the department's work. We have a number of dedicated accounts. For example, in enforcement, you can see Game and Fish Fund is 61% of their budget, so that we spend 60% of our time doing game and fish things. General Fund is only 8.2% of our budget, and that's where we do our wetlands enforcement, our public safety work. So funding drives our activities. It's just something you need to keep in the back of your mind, because we have very strict or very strong statutory sideboards on these accounts, and fund integrity and making sure we're spending those dollars on their dedicated purposes is something that we are required to do by law. Division of Enforcement, it's pretty simple. They enforce all of our natural resource laws, game and fish, wetlands, aquatic plants, boats, snowmobiles, ATVs, other recreational vehicles, commercial operations, aquaculture industry, for example. We're making sure that they're regulating or operating within the confines of the law. And then our safety and education programs, firearm safety, snowmobile safety, all of our safety programs are coordinated out of the Division of Enforcement as well. Ecological and Water Resources. This agency, we used to have a separate division of Ecological Resources and Waters, a division of Waters. About 4 years ago, those two divisions were combined to help work, as we were talking about earlier, in a more watershed-based approach, so we can deal with these ecological issues on a watershed or a land-based management system. This division works on the long-term health of watersheds that support water quality, biodiversity and ecological system services, and then critical information on regulatory oversight to state and local governments and landowners to foster that natural resource stewardship. Fish and Wildlife Division, you can see here, probably have one of our larger budgets. There's a lot of federal dollars that come into this budget as well, but the Game and Fish Fund is 61%, similar to the Enforcement Division's breakdown, but it's almost $140 million. That's on a biennial basis, and that includes a lot of the Dingell Johnson Waller Perot federal dollars that come into that division as well. And their mission is basically conserve and manage and enhance the populations of our state's fish and wildlife through regulation, enforcement, research, monitoring, and education, and then preserve our culture as well. Recruitment and retention of our hunters and anglers in the state are very important to us. You'll see some things in our Game and Fish Bill that will allow us to further that mission and goals. Recruiting new members into the hunting and fishing system as well is also very important to us. Women and children, making sure people understand how much of a cultural heritage to Minnesotans hunting and fishing actually is. Our Division of Forestry, you can see here they have about $146 million budget, which 25% or so is general fund. The rest is a variety of different funds. Forestry is under a lot of different pressures right now between the issues related to the markets, the issues we've had recently with the timber blowdown and fire, invasive species, forest pests are a huge concern for us, and maintaining that supply of wood that you'll learn about and how much that actually means to not only the people who cut down the timber, but the metropolitan area has a number of manufacturing jobs that are based on, dependent upon that use of timber to make cabinets and chairs and everything else that you can think of. We're working very hard to provide sustainable yield of forest resources and products. Providing clean water, wildlife habitat, and recreation is ultimate benefits from those products as well. And also the school trust resources, forest products, paper, and also gravel. Lands and minerals. Manages our agency real estate portfolio of minerals and lands that are out there, transactions, promotes, regulates, and provides expertise on mineral exploration, mining, and mine land reclamation, manages our state-owned mineral assets, and also manages our school trust mineral resources. Our Division of Parks and Trails, sorry about that. It's actually a picture of the Bluffs in Blue Mountain State Park. I think it's a so that's why I'm showing it to you several times. Sorry. Division of Parks and Trails, one of our probably more populous divisions with locations throughout the state in our 67 parks and state rec areas. Operates a system of park and state forest recreation areas that conserve natural, scenic, and cultural resources. Maintains a statewide network of recreational trails. Provides public access, lakes, rivers, and streams, and also provides environmental education and grants, regional and community recreation opportunity. We do the grant program for the legacy funds for outstate Minnesota. So we work, those dollars are appropriated to us. We work to get those dollars out through our parks and trails, Division and also on several other grant programs. You can see the funding here. $35 million is general fund. This has declined significantly over the past decade, and we'll be needing to talk about what those declines mean to the system we have as we move forward. But we also, you know, $94 million, 45% in natural resources fund. That's made up of parks and trails, people paying to come into the park system, and the dollars they camp and the wood they buy and things like that. So there's a lot of different activities there. And as I said, I will be working with you all as your main point of contact into the department and helping you answer questions here. And here's just my office number, 259-5024. My cell phone number is on here as well, and my email. I'm in the process of trying to get meetings set up with all of you individually to talk about issues you may have. Feel free to call me anytime. Shoot me an email. I'll get back to you as quickly as possible. And
thank you, Mr. Meyer. You did a very good job of wrapping up in 20 minutes, or 18 minutes, I guess. Any urgent questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
Just for our committee staff, I don't see a save folder. Can we just stick our stuff back in the...
Yes.
Okay. Yes, yeah. We will put a save folder
we'll
in there for
time.
People.
All right, great. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you all. And with that, this meeting is... we will be meeting again next Tuesday and Thursday, is it? Yeah, next Tuesday and Thursday, and we'll be getting out agenda very soon for that. Thank you very much. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.